Brazil declares war on the Zika virus today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Our reporting team is in Brazil this week, talking to officials there about the battle against Zika.
It's a war. We need to send everything that we have, not only soldiers.
Plus, a young Nigerian woman is abducted by Boko Haram extremists and then falls in love with one of their commanders.
She said he bought her clothes, bought her food, made sure she was comfortable, and then her exact words, he gave me everything that a woman needs from a man.
Also, the United Arab Emirates appoints a minister of happiness, and the Arab world responds tongue-in-cheek.
Egyptians, for instance, have their own minister of depression. They think they deserve it.
Those stories are coming up here on The World. And by the way, Marco will be back tomorrow, fresh from his reporting trip to Iran. Can't wait to hear the stories he'll have for us starting tomorrow. Today, though, we kick off the week in Brazil. It's the epicenter of the global health emergency involving Zika. And it's the country where doctors first noticed the suspected link between the mosquito-borne virus and serious birth defects. But Zika is only part of a much bigger story in Brazil. It's a story about mosquitoes and public health and water and women. That's why we've sent our Across Women's Lives team to Brazil for the next 2 weeks to report on all of the above. We're checking in first today with The World's Carolyn Beeler. We reached her in Araraquara, a city 150 miles north of Sao Paulo.
So we are about to go along with a professor who's going to be collecting blood and mosquito samples from homes of people who live near suspected cases of Zika. So they're neighbors of people who might have Zika. And these researchers are then going to take these samples back to the lab and isolate the Zika virus and study the mosquitoes to try to learn more about the virus. One of the things that researchers are looking at is if different mosquito populations in different parts of the country are better at carrying Zika and transmitting it then to humans.
That sounds like really important next step stuff. While we're on this, I know that there are other diseases besides Zika that are carried by these same mosquitoes. Is there concern down there about, for instance, dengue fever as well?
There is. A lot of the government messaging right now is about Zika because there's so much news and so much information out there about Zika. So the other day we were walking down the streets of Sao Paulo and the military was handing out pamphlets instructing people on how to reduce the standing water in their homes, the standing water where mosquitoes can breed. So sort of the messaging is all about Zika. But, you know, we were in a favela the other day and they're still concerned more about dengue, which is sort of right because the dengue killed more than 800 people in Brazil in 2015. That's about double the number that they killed in 2014. So the messaging is sort of all about Zika, but because they're carried by the same mosquito, you know, any work to reduce the spread of Zika is also going to help reduce the spread of dengue, which is a killer, whereas Zika is sort of a fear and an emerging threat, but it's just not as deadly.
Is there a concern that science like this is going to move too slowly to help people who are getting Zika now?
Well, the hope with this research is that, you know, if there's a certain gene or characteristic of one population of mosquitoes that makes them very good at transmitting it to humans, that could be sort of turned into maybe a targeted insecticide or, you know, some sort of gene therapy into the future. And that science does take a long time. But there's also a lot of work being done on the ground right now with mosquito control and other more immediate measures. And I just spoke this morning to a researcher at the University of Sao Paulo, Dr. Margaret Capuro, who said, you know, when you're in a moment like this, you have to use all of the tools in your toolbox. And she used a really good sort of analogy to describe that.
I always say about mosquitoes or about the dengue or the disease, we need to think as a general. It's a war. We need to send everything that we have, not only soldiers.
How are you guys keeping yourselves safe from mosquitoes while you're reporting?
Well, we have some long sleeve hooded shirts that have built-in insect repellent. We're spraying ourselves with insect repellent before we go out into the field. So we're keeping ourselves safe. And one important thing to note is that, you know, this sort of disproportionately affects the poor who have open windows because they don't have air conditioning and might have standing water because of trash in their neighborhood. So for some people, it's much more of a risk than others. And you know, we're pretty confident that we can keep ourselves safe.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, who's on the ground in the city of Araraquara, Brazil. Thanks so much, Carolyn.
You're welcome, Jeb.
You can keep up with the latest from our Across Women's Lives team in Brazil. Follow us on Snapchat and see them as they head out with biologists to collect mosquitoes. Just search for Women's Lives. Plus, find more of our stories from Brazil at pri.org/herplanet. Anybody traveling to Latin America is being warned about Zika these days. That would include Pope Francis, who's in the middle of his visit to Mexico right now. That hasn't altered his itinerary, though. Today, the Pope traveled to Mexico's southern extreme, the state of Chiapas, on the border with Guatemala. His agenda there included saying Mass in three of Mexico's indigenous languages. Reporter Frank Contreras is in the neighboring state of Oaxaca. What does it mean that the Pope is there to celebrate indigenous culture and language?
Well, first off, Jeb, this is historic. No Pope in the history of the Catholic Church has ever gone to that part of Mexico. But secondly, it's a very specific part of Mexico that this Pope, Pope Francis, has decided to visit. It's the highlands of Chiapas where the 1990s Zapatista armed rebellion took place. This was the site actually where indigenous rebels of the Mayan highlands of Mexico took up arms against the Mexican government. And so it's quite symbolic because it is a place where most people don't even speak Spanish. Their first language is one of the three or four different languages that are spoken in that part of the highlands of Chiapas: Tzotzil, Tzeltal, Chol, those kinds of languages that, you know, really mark a strong cultural difference from the rest of the country.
It's also interesting that last year Pope Francis in Bolivia issued a sweeping apology for the Catholic Church's colonial era sins against indigenous people. Do you expect more of that kind of message to people in Chiapas?
Definitely, this decision authorizing Catholic priests in that region to actually give Mass in the three languages of the Chiapan Highlands is a strong nod in that direction. The Mexican people receiving a strong plea from the Pope himself requesting pardon for this history of bloodshed that took place at the hands of the Christian Catholic faith and the Church itself. As you know, the conquest took place in the 1500s. This is the leader of the Catholic faith stepping foot on these places where the conquest took place. And again, you know, requesting a pardon. This would be like white plantation owners in places like Alabama asking black families for the pardon of having black slaves in that part of the United States.
And the church isn't uniform, right? The Vatican and the local church in Mexico have clashed on this stuff in the past.
Absolutely. And one of the key figures in that clash was a priest named Samuel Ruiz. Samuel Ruiz was somebody who fought for indigenous rights, and he worked as a mediator between both sides, between the Zapatista rebels and the Mexican government. And one of the things that the Pope will be doing on this day is visiting the tomb of Father Samuel Ruiz. And so, again, this is a very powerful symbol because Samuel Ruiz, by the viewpoint of some of the most conservative forces in the Vatican, was absolutely someone who was taking the wrong path. He was involved with the liberation theology movement in this part of Mexico. For the Pope to come up and now pay a visit even is quite a shift.
I'm curious about the logistics, too. I gather Francis is sleeping in Mexico City so that when he travels to a place like Chiapas, he's going all the way out and then all the way back to the capital again. And that's causing a lot of congestion in and around the main airport in Mexico City. What have you seen?
Well, when the Pope goes back to his hotel in Mexico City tonight, there will be once again havoc. On Tuesday, he'll be visiting the western Mexican state of Michoacán, where drug violence has taken place, where methamphetamine labs are still working. And when he makes that move, again, traffic havoc will take place in Mexico City. And so people are sort of just getting used to it.
Were people prepared for this? Did the authorities know there'd be all this havoc and congestion?
Well, it did go out in the news and people were given some fair warning, but there were some of us, me, for example, who didn't quite get the message. And so just about missing flights to get to other parts of Mexico. But yeah, this is creating quite a stir here at many levels.
Reporter Frank Contreras in Mexico. Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you, Jeb.
The United Arab Emirates made news recently by creating a brand new government job, the Minister of Happiness. The title might sound silly to us, but my BBC colleague, Doa Suleiman in Cairo, says there's more to it than we might think.
Although the word happiness is the direct translation of the Arabic word sa'ada, the Arabic word also have other aspects for words like pleasure or contentment or satisfaction. So the Arabic name of Wazir al-Sa'ada or Minister of Happiness is way more serious, I would say, more it has more weight into it than happiness, to be frank.
We're having some fun with this, but the idea they're trying to project is something quite forward-looking and substantial.
Yes, yes, that's true. But I have to tell you that also we in the Arab world, we had lots of fun with the wording and with the notion of having a minister of happiness in the first place.
Tell us the reaction, some of the good social media.
Yeah, social media it went crazy over the notion of a minister of happiness. One instance is a hashtag, an Arabic hashtag. If I wear minister of happiness, لو كنت وزيرا لسعادة, that hashtag was used more than 30,000 times in one day or in less. People are just saying, what would they do if they were given a chance to be the ministers of happiness in their countries? And comments are coming from all over the world.
What are the examples? What do they want to do?
Whoa, well, you name it. Some people are saying they will distribute chocolate, flowers, nail polish at points. Some ladies were saying nail polish can cheer everyone up. So another one said that he will pass a law fining anyone who does not laugh. So if you're walking in the street, you're not laughing, you can actually be fined in the street, according to this reader. The Emiratis specifically were celebrating in a sense of pride. They are very proud of their government. And they went as far as saying that if I wear, and I'm quoting here one of the tweeters, if I were a minister in happiness in the UAE, I would not find anything else to do.
So UAE has its Minister of Happiness. What kinds of ministries would other Arab countries like to have?
Well, this is a hard question to answer when I'm trying to give a serious face, because when I look at a country like Egypt, people try to compare the situation in Egypt to this of the UAE, and they came up with a couple of ministers. So Egyptians, for instance, have their own minister of depression. They think they deserve it. And a minister of despair as well. So are the two ministers that Egyptians are really speaking about on social media. And so desperate, you know, like he really
so painful. Carried
exactly. Another country, Jordan, for instance, they also are comparing their situation with that of the UAE, and they think they don't stand a chance in a happiness minister, but they definitely can have their own sadness or depression ministers. So, yeah, these are some of the answers that other Arab countries got.
In the UAE, we've heard a lot about the way foreign workers have been badly treated. Are either of these ministries aimed at helping with that?
Well, this is another conversation that is taking place at the moment. Okay, so there are lots of people who are making fun and joking and celebrating the new ministers, but others are asking, would they make a difference in the lives of non-Emiratis, the non-citizens? Because the UAE has around 80% of residents who are not Emiratis, non-citizens living in the country, workers, and their situation is not really the best. So a lot of people are asking at the moment, would these two ministers help make the lives of everyone in the UAE happier, better, or only Emiratis, only citizens? And so far, although no one spoke directly about this, but I can tell you that the statements are speaking about the society. They did not say something like citizens, they did not say something like Emiratis, but they are speaking of happiness of the society and tolerance of the society. And you know, looking at the situation, I can tell you that a minister of tolerance, she can actually play a huge role in the Emirati society, because this is a society that definitely needs more tolerance and can do a lot with more acceptance.
Doa Suleiman is a BBC colleague in Cairo. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeb. Thanks for your time. Thanks a lot.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. The late Antonin Scalia made history when he became the first Italian-American appointed to the Supreme Court. But how important was his Italian heritage? I put that question to Justice Scalia's biographer, Joan Biskupic. She's a legal affairs editor for Reuters.
Well, it was very important to him personally, and it's probably what got him through a smooth confirmation back in 1986. He was a first-generation Italian-American, was very proud of his heritage. He went back to Italy after he was confirmed. And I remember him telling me about the kind of welcome he got. There was a parade, and he rode down the street, and I forget the name of the little town that he was in, but he was standing up on a balcony, and all these people were cheering, as if, he said, I think they thought I even was Ronald Reagan. And he said they were cheering so much that he quipped, I felt like Mussolini.
And why do you say that that's probably what got him through his confirmation hearings?
Well, he was nominated by Ronald Reagan in 1986 at a time when there was, you know, some tensions over confirmations. And Teddy Kennedy, the great late Democratic senator from Massachusetts, was sort of set to give him a hard time. But Massachusetts is home to many Italian Americans, and he stressed that during the hearing. In fact, you'd be amused that during the confirmation hearing, just about every senator up there in the Senate Judiciary Committee vetting the nominee had to claim some Italian connection. And one senator by the name of Howell Heflin from Alabama, he's now deceased, but I remember him saying something to the effect, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that I had an aunt who once had a babysitter who was related to somebody who was Italian.
You know? I love it.
That was it. Everybody was claiming that ethnicity.
That's really funny. So how important was his appointment to the Supreme Court to the Italian-American community?
Oh, I remember they embraced him. I went back through the records in the Reagan administration when I was doing my book, and just about every Italian-American group in the United States sent in an endorsement. You know, I remember at the time being surprised that there was still some lingering concern about, you know, Italians and the mob and law enforcement issues. But I think that a lot of Italians felt it was important to be validated in terms of somebody who was going to the nation's highest court, standing for law and order, being one of them. And in fact, he told me that when he was growing up, you know, that he would often hear some slurs. And his wife, Maureen, was from Massachusetts, and she would talk about, she told me that she remembers that as a child, too. So, you know, now here we are in 2016, that really seems like a whole nother era. But even in the 80s, that was still lingering enough that it was very important to the Italian-American community here.
He was born in Trenton, New Jersey, but he always identified as a New Yorker living in Elmhurst in Queens. And it seems like his upbringing in that particular immigrant neighborhood was pretty significant, right?
It was. It was. He was in a very ethnic area. He went to high school at a Jesuit school here that was prominent. He did see himself as sort of a city boy, but interestingly enough, that he learned to fire a rifle when he was in high school. You wouldn't think of that. And he would talk about riding on the subway in New York with his little rifle case. But that back in those days, they would teach marksmanship. And he was quite proud of that. And that's what got him first interested in hunting. And then he would go out to Long Island, where his grandfather was, and shoot rabbits. And so he always was a recreational hunter that way.
All these little surprising details. Joan, any final thoughts about Antonin Scalia?
There just will never be another justice like him. He lived larger than life, as President Obama said, and part of his living larger than life was his very deep commitment to his Italian heritage and his love. He loved traveling. He went overseas regularly. He really was a man who was a student of the world, a student of the law, and someone who will certainly have an enduring legacy, not just for America, but across the globe.
Joan Biskupic is legal affairs editor for Reuters and author of a biography of Antonin Scalia called American Original. Joan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk Swedish food now. No, really. Go to IKEA and you can get the meatballs and all the rest for cheap, or for a few bucks more. Well, many bucks more. You can check out Aquavit in New York. It's a big-name restaurant that's flown the flag of Swedish cooking for years. The chef in charge these days is Emma Bengtsson.
It started off with my grandmother. She grew up working on a farm for a family, being their housemaid, cook, doing basically everything from the scratch. you didn't have really supermarkets back then, so you had to do your own butter and milk the cow and everything from scratch. And every time we came to visit, she would have spent days in the kitchen preparing everything. So if to spend time with her as well, I had to be in the kitchen. And that's how I think I started just eating everything while she was cooking it, to actually being able to help out. She used to do a steak with carrots boiled in a lot of butter, salt. The meat itself would spend 3 days in the oven. You didn't have to use a knife. It just fell apart. It was amazing. Also her desserts that she was doing. She was doing a Swedish rice pudding. All the cookies. I could eat nonstop when I was there. She would always season everything very well. She would never hold back on flavor, so I get that from her. I use a lot of salt. Akvavit is one of those restaurants that everyone knows about. I'm here 7 days a week from morning to night, so when I have my days off, I want to do things that take my mind off food, just for a little bit. And I've been dancing for the last 5-6 years. And that's one of the things that when I learn a choreography or when I'm social dancing with other people and hearing the music, that allows me to shut off the food for a little bit of time. I also recently, on a dance trip, we went down to Dallas, and the guys I was with, they took me to a shooting range. And I didn't really tell them that I used to compete in air shooting as well when I was a kid. So they were also concerned because I was the only girl with them. And we all did it. And it turned out I got offered a position in their female shooting group if I wanted it. And I was like, no, I'm not from Dallas. I'm actually from New York. But thank you. So it was really funny to mess around with them a little.
That's Emma Bengtsson, the shooting and dancing, slicing and dicing executive chef at Akvavit, a Swedish restaurant in New York. She told her story to producer Alex Galifant. News headlines are coming up next, and later in the show, we check out Otherhood, a new podcast exploring the immigrant experience in the United States. You're with the world. I'm Jeb Sharp. Rupa Shenoy grew up Indian American in Iowa, so she knows about otherhood.
Otherhood is people who don't belong, who are between cultures. But really, I've been trying to not define it so much. I want people to define it for themselves.
So she turned Otherhood into a podcast. That story ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Zahra John was just 14 years old the day Boko Haram extremists stormed into her isolated village in Nigeria. That was 2 years ago. The militants slaughtered the men. Then they forced the women and girls to board several trucks and abducted them. 2 months later, a commander named Ali took Zahra as his wife.
He tattooed his name onto her stomach with a knife and with charcoal. He had told her that with that mark he'd made on her stomach, whenever he came back from battle, he would be able to identify her. And even if he died in battle, anyone who saw that tattoo would know she's a Boko Haram commander's wife and they will treat her well.
That's Nigerian journalist Adobe Trisha Nwabani. She spoke with Zahra after Nigeria's military rescued the teenager. Nwabani recounts how Zahra described her abduction and her mother's 2 years ago.
The truck was so full that her mom fell out, but she kept chasing after it because it had her daughter, Zahra, and her four-year-old son. So she ran as fast as she could, for as long as she could, and of course, eventually she had to give up. So that's how Zahra was kidnapped and taken to a town somewhere called Bita. And she was there for about a year until the Nigerian military rescued her.
And what did she tell you about her life there?
She said as soon as they arrived, the Boko Haram men told them that they were now their slaves. And so they started living a life of doing chores and being shouted at and, of course, learning the Quran and being taught how to be good Muslim women because they got them converted. And so that was the life she lived for about 2 months until she was married off to a Boko Haram commander.
And she enjoyed a lot of privileges as the wife of a commander.
She moved from cramped quarters to a house. Well, it had a thatched roof, she said, but it was theirs, just two of them inhabiting that. So life was a lot easier for her when compared to when she was being treated as a slave. She had to cook only for her husband, to take care of him. And she described a man who was kind to her. She said he told her stories of his family. He was a fisherman, and he joined Boko Haram after his father and his brother were killed by the Nigerian military, and that was when he joined Boko Haram. So she described him as a good man. And she said he had told her that they would go, after the war was over, they would go back to Baga together and resume his fishing business. You know, she described a man who was loving. She said he bought her clothes, bought her food, made sure she was comfortable. And then her exact word, he gave me everything that a woman needs from a man.
And then that ends because she's rescued by the Nigerian army. What did she tell you about that?
I asked her how she felt when she was rescued, and she said if she had a gun at the time the Nigerian military came to rescue her, she would have shot the soldiers. The first thing she thought was, these infidels, these unbelievers have come to disturb us. And her husband had traveled some days before that attack. He had told her he was going into battle. So he had left, given her a mobile phone, and he would call her from time to time to find out how she was doing. And he tattooed his name onto her stomach. Anyone who saw that tattoo will know she's a Boko Haram commander's wife and they will treat her well. And they will never again force her to marry anyone, that she was his and will be identified as his forever and be treated accordingly.
Adobe, how do you read this? What kind of transition do you think she went through? I mean, is it a kind of brainwashing?
The first thing people will say is Stockholm Syndrome, and perhaps it's a factor in a sense, but this is a 14-year-old girl who came from an environment where women normally are not treated in the best of ways. Like, she would be cleaning and cooking and serving a man anyway, or serving some men. She described somebody she loved, somebody she would still like to be in touch with. She had kept in touch with even after she was rescued, until her phone was seized by the soldiers when they noticed that some of the girls in the camp were in touch with the Boko Haram men. So it's not even only her. She said that the soldiers noticed that a number of the girls were still in touch with the men, and then they seized their phones and relocated them to another camp. It's a part of Nigeria where things are not as they are in other parts of the world. And she found herself in this new life, being valued by one man, being told how they were changing the world, how they were fighting a war, how they were going to start a new life. She's been with her family after she was released from the camp.
Yeah, how did they receive her?
One of her uncles, who has some level of wealth, relocated her and her mother and her brother to another part of the northeast. They found out she was pregnant after she was taken to the camp, and the family deliberated, the men in the family were deciding what to do with the baby or about the baby. Some wanted her to have an abortion. Some felt it isn't the child's fault. He shouldn't be made to pay for his father's crimes. And the majority said, let's keep the baby.
She had some contact with the husband, the commander, afterwards or not?
Yes, she has. She said after she was rescued and taken to the camp by the Nigerian soldiers, he phoned her and he told her he would come and rescue her. She said she was so thrilled when he said that. She was so happy to hear from him. She's 16. I think that's the age when people do these kind of things. Even we have 14-year-olds, 16-year-olds leaving their homes to join ISIS from what we read.
Yeah, that's a great example. And also these Boko Haram girls last week who went to target a displaced camp, and two of the girls blew themselves up and they killed 58 people or more. But the third girl didn't detonate her device because she was worried her father or family members were in the camps. But it shows that line. I mean, these girls are vulnerable to the teachings, or they're coerced
exactly.
to be vulnerable.
Especially when she described to me why she was able to tolerate the pain of the tattoo, the knife and the charcoal, because she said he explained to me why he had to do it. And so the pain, you know, the pain was bearable. In other words, if someone took the time to explain to them and to persuade them why they needed to take a certain course of action, even if it was going to be painful or hurtful to people, as far as they understood and imbibed and believed, they would be prepared to blow up themselves.
Nigerian novelist and journalist Adobe Tricia Nwabani describing the story of Zara John, a teenage girl who was abducted by Boko Haram. For the past few years, Colombia's government has been negotiating a peace agreement with the FARC rebel group. They are reportedly close to a deal now. Peace after 50 years of civil war would radically change Colombian society. Millions have fled rural parts of the country for the safety of Colombia's cities. And for many women, that's meant finding city work as maids. They earn very little and have few labor rights. They're also invisible to most of society, a silent force that keeps the country running. Maggie Donaldson has the story of one woman in Colombia's capital, Bogota.
High-rises full of fancy apartments are going up all over central Bogota. In one of them, Belen Garcia cleans the floor beneath a king-size bed. Behind her, the giant picture windows have sweeping views of the city. Every week, she cleans three wealthy households like this one.
Juan Carlos, aquí me pierdo.
¿Sí? ¿Qué va?
Garcia calls out to the man she's working for that morning, telling him his house is too big, she might get lost. Garcia is one of a million registered domestic workers in Colombia, most of them women who've crowded into cities to escape their country's armed conflict. Her job includes laundry, cooking, scrubbing floors, and after a full eight-hour day, she makes 40,000 pesos, about $10. That's about the same as Colombia's minimum wage, but she stretches it to pay for groceries, rent, and school supplies for her two daughters. Garcia's been working as a maid since she was 16. She started in her native city of Manizales, 6 hours away from Bogota. Then Garcia got married, but says her husband began abusing her.
Me dio una golpiza. Con la argolla el matrimonio me rompió la cabeza.
Garcia says her husband forced her to move to a rural area, Sumapaz. FARC guerrillas controlled it, and Garcia suspects her husband was a sympathizer. Things quickly got dangerous for her and her children.
Pero de un momento para otro no está tranquilo y le tocó dejar todo.
Suddenly you go from being very calm to having to leave everything, she says. Garcia fled to Bogota with her two daughters. She joined the thousands of displaced women with few prospects but cleaning homes.
This inequality makes these women to not be respected.
That's Colombian lawyer Valentina Montoya. Right now she's at Harvard researching the labor conditions of Colombian domestic workers. Her family is one of Garcia's employers.
Some of the most important women and persons in my life have been people who have worked for my family in different senses, and I really feel a connection with domestic workers.
Montoya says upper middle class women owe a lot to their maids. They do a lot of the cooking and cleaning and childcare that kept wealthier women out of the labor market here. Right now, domestic workers in Colombia don't have the right to unionize and demand benefits like healthcare or paid sick days. Their issues are only starting to get noticed. Belen Garcia doesn't have time for activism. When she's not working, she's commuting. A 3-hour bus ride every morning and 3 hours back late at night. We take the ride with her to a shanty town in Ciudad Bolivar. This is where she can afford to live on her wages, an area with the highest crime rate in Bogota. As we ride there, Garcia looks out the window. The houses are getting ugly, and the trees seem lifeless, she says. At the last stop, her two teenage daughters meet us. It's best for women to walk in groups. Garcia asks us to hide the recorder while we walk up a dark path. We get a tour of their tiny cinder block home. Garcia's 14-year-old daughter Jenny says sometimes she and her sister wish they could grow up faster, get good jobs to support their mother. Jenny says they don't want to end up as maids. I don't like people calling them servants. I feel like they underestimate them, humiliate them, Jenny says. But their mom, Belen, will keep doing what she has to keep a roof over their heads. That roof, by the way, is made of sheet metal. Garcia explains that the roof is now tied with twine to the furniture. It nearly blew off a few nights ago. For The World, I'm Maggie Donaldson in Bogota.
Maggie's story was co-reported by Camila Osorio. If you've been following the climate change debate for a while, the name Rajendra Pachauri should sound familiar. He's the former chair of the UN panel on climate change. Last February, he was accused of sexual harassment by a researcher who worked at his institute in India. An internal investigation there found him guilty, so Pachauri stepped down. Now a new allegation of harassment has been leveled against him. We asked reporter Ritu Chatterjee for an update on Pachauri's case. She's written about this for Science magazine.
He's a pretty public figure here in India. In 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore for all his work in climate change. And India's proud of him for his international stature and for the fact that he got India the Nobel Peace Prize. And he helped build this institute that he's headed since 2001, the Energy and Resources Institute, better known as TERI, based here in New Delhi.
And why have the allegations surfaced again? Why is there a fuss right now?
So what happened last week was that the institute, TERI, announced that he was being made the executive vice chairman. So in some senses, his position at TERI was being elevated from the director to the executive vice chairman. And that's when the uproar began, because the media, women's rights activists, and even former students of TERI University came out and said that instead of punishing this man, who was at least by this internal committee found guilty, how can you elevate him? When you let him go and when you further elevate his standing in a workplace, then you're sending a message to all powerful men throughout the country in various workplaces that this is okay. And so this case has indeed become a big symbol of India's fight against sexual violence, especially in the workplace.
What is happening in the courts? Is there actually a legal case against Mr. Pachauri?
So the police is investigating it. And from what the Indian media here reports and what the first complainant's lawyer told me is that the police has said that they're going to file what they call a charge sheet, following which there will be a court case. But as of now, you know, who's to say how this will go? However, I should point out that Dr. Pachauri did ask for an anticipatory bail from the courts, which the courts granted, and they have also allowed him to travel to some 9 or 10 countries in the past year, despite having an ongoing police investigation into the case.
Ritu, give us a sense of how this is going down in India.
So the thing to remember, Jeb, and, you know, I've covered the issue of sexual violence against women in India since 2012, when the horrific gang rape that's now come to be called as the Delhi gang rape took place, and all the changes that have been going on in India. Since then, there were a lot of protests and a lot of legal changes that came about in India. Before that, there were guidelines to help employers deal with this, but the 2013 Sexual Harassment in the Workplace Act actually requires employers to have these bodies to look into this cases of sexual harassment. But the sad thing is that the vast majority of employers have done nothing towards it.
These cases are always hard in the sense of until something's in a court of law, until you have evidence and you have a decision one way or the other, they're uncomfortable to talk about. That's as true here in the United States as it is over there in India. You're a former scientist yourself. You've navigated the world of science both places. I just wonder if you have any strong sense of how differently this might be playing out if it were happening here versus there.
That's a great question, Jeb, because in this past year, we have seen 2 major cases of sexual harassment in the workplace coming out of academics, science in particular, in the United States. There was a case of where a young researcher alleged a very well-known astronomer in Berkeley. And the most recent case was of a physical anthropologist who allegedly harassed another younger researcher at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And the way academics there reacted was by, there was a sense of outrage. There were more stories that sort of came out, and there were, you know, senior scientists who stepped up and said, okay, let's recognize that this is a pervasive problem and let's try and do something about it. Whereas here, I've yet to see or hear any prominent scientists speak up against this case. It's mostly women's rights activists and students and the media that's speaking up here.
That was reporter Ritu Chatterjee in New Delhi. I'm Jeb Sharp with The World, and I want to tell you now about a podcast that I absolutely love. It's called Otherhood, and it's hosted by my WGBH colleague, reporter Rupa Shenoy. She shares the stories of people who came to the United States as immigrants or are the children of immigrants. And Rupa, I understand this is a really personal project. Where did the idea come from?
It came from me and my own experiences. I am the child of immigrants. My parents are from South India, and I grew up in Iowa. And that leads to certain experiences that I share with many people whose parents came to this country in the 1960s and 70s and have been coming ever since then.
And the name is pretty striking, Otherhood. Give us a sense of that.
Otherhood is people who don't belong, who are between cultures. But really, I've been trying to not define it so much. I want people to define it for themselves. And also, it's kind of what I'm exploring in more of a reporting kind of way.
Partly what I love about the podcast is you just plunged us right inside those conversations. And as you say, you're not defining it. And we're going to play a clip now that kind of gives people a sense of that.
Our whole lives, we search for community, people with whom we feel we belong. For kids of immigrants, the search is complex. I can only speak from my own experience. I never had the option of being among my own kind. I didn't know who my community was until I met Ava Romero.
For the record, can you confirm that you are my lifelong best friend?
Yes.
Thank you.
I confirm this.
Okay.
I'm Indian. I was raised in Iowa. And Ava?
Well, I was born in the Midwest. I was raised in South America. I moved back to the Midwest after high school. And then I came to the Southwest 10 years ago.
Ava Romero and I are opposites. She's an academic. I'm a reporter. In the photos of our vacations over the years, we always joke that Ava sprawls for pictures, posing like a hot Latina, and I sit there like a proper buttoned-up Indian girl. But Ava and I discovered otherness together a long time ago, and we figured it out together, bonding us for life.
I think it's kind of interesting that we're in this moment where we're talking about, like, race, and everybody is being a little bit defensive of their tribe. But what we're talking about is something that really, I mean, we bond very strongly with people who are not of the same national origin or the same skin color or the same ethnicity.
Ava and I aren't an isolated case. Kids of immigrants tend to be friends with kids of immigrants from other backgrounds. The best example might be stoner BFFs Harold and Kumar.
Sorry. So, is there a problem, Officer Palumbo?
Is there a problem? You ever heard of jaywalking? I'm writing you up a ticket.
A ticket? Are you serious?
Kumar, shut up. That's not the kind of tone you want to use in a cop. You could bust your ass.
Bust my ass?
Yeah, Kumar. Bust your ass. What kind of name is that anyhow, huh? Kumar. What is that, like five O's? They're having the good old American names like Dave or Jim, you know?
Harold.
Are you kidding?
No, that's a great name.
Let me take care of
this. You should be proud of that name, son.
Why don't you just take this quiet little Asian guy with the anglicized name that suits you so well and give him a couple other tickets? Better yet, just take him to jail.
Better
idea. Just arrest him. Does that work out for you okay, Harold?
Perfect.
Oh, great. Right, Harold. Name, Harold.
Thanks to your buddy. We're going down.
If kids of immigrants haven't experienced something like what you heard in that clip themselves, they probably have a friend who has.
So, Rupa, what's your Harold and Kumar-like experience?
Oh, we have many, many, many Harold and Kumar-like experiences. So Ava was visiting me. I was living in Minneapolis. Minneapolis has many, many lakes. And we were walking around a lake at dusk. We got lost. Apparently, you weren't supposed to be there past a certain time. And police stopped us and came out and talked to us. And Ava and I were just, you know, we're in sundresses. And Ava, like I said, she has a tendency to flirt with everyone. So she went on to do this. And I was the straight person trying to calm things down. And they were just rude and brusque. And these aren't the most horrible incidents, but they give us insight into things like how police treat African Americans. And they help us relate to a very large group of people. That's kind of the larger point, that there is a huge class of people now, like Ava and myself, who are bonded across race, who never belong themselves and belong to other people who didn't belong.
You know what's so lovely about the way you describe it is otherness suggests this apartness and this separateness, and yet this whole thing is so unifying. And I feel as if the podcast does that too. It brings so many people into this really rich conversation. I'm curious what epiphanies you've had, you know, several episodes in. Is your sense of what otherness is shifting?
So I started out my career as a reporter at a place called the Chicago Reporter. It's a race and poverty-focused magazine. Ever since then, I've been reporting on issues of police treatment of African Americans, things like that. And I have always, my whole life, known cross-cultural people who cared about issues like that. And I've always wondered, you know, is this a thing? Are we like this in general? And I've really found that that's the case. A lot of people are. In this last episode, I talked to a researcher who is studying the impact of the Asian model minority stereotype on other minorities. So in other words, the model minority stereotype is being used in the minds of people who believe in it to hold other minorities down in comparison. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it's something that someone out there like me is thinking about. And
well, it just reminds me that you're dealing with actually quite uncomfortable topics.
Yes.
But with a lot of laughter and humor and intimacy.
Yes. I think the thing is that we don't know the answers and we can't be afraid to talk about them. And a lot of people aren't, because I am a small Asian woman. I threaten very few people. It gives me entrance into many conversations, many communities. I want to share that with people. You know, you can be included in all these conversations.
What else is coming up in future episodes?
There's so much. Okay. Who do we marry and why? People who are the children of immigrants, or not even children of immigrants, anyone who is a person of color. I mean, the person that they fall in love with is a political choice. Other things, like when you go back to your parents' country, all the feelings that that brings up. And also the impact that we're having on those countries. We are a huge class of diplomats who are connected to those cultures, who have opinions about them.
I think you're going to be busy with it for a long time. Rupa Shenoy is the host of Otherhood, a podcast about immigrants and the children of immigrants. Get it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much, Rupa.
Thank you.
You can also read some of Rupa's stories from the podcast at pri.org/otherhood. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Jeb Sharp. Marco Werman is back in the host chair tomorrow with lots of stories from his trip to Iran, so be sure to tune in.
PRI, Public Radio International.